Okay, folks, ready for the two questions? Who's not in a group yet? Come on, we have a poor, forlorn soul. Take him in your group. So if anybody has a group of four, wants a group, a fifth person, five, wants an extra person, I'm sure somebody will find you, you know. If not, by the end of this week. Second question, and you know it's coming. Who's not picked a company yet? Okay, you know what you need to do. Okay, so let's get started. Remember in the last session I talked about social costs and social benefits and how it's easy in the abstract to say, hey, we should bring them all in, but in practice it's difficult because it's subjective. Your social costs and my social cost perceptions can be very different. It's going to paralyze you. If this becomes the basis for your decision making, you're never going to reach an end game. So I'm going to put you on the spot. If you open up the annual report for any company, what does every company claim to be? Socially responsible. In fact, half the annual report is filled with what my good friend Scott Galloway likes to call yoga babble, which is fuzzy stuff. Oh, look how good we are. Look at these pictures of our employees helping out the helpless kind of thing. That train's left the station. We're all supposed to be socially responsible. And at least, read the annual report, every company claims to be so. So I'm going to put you on the spot. And Disney is a company, if you look at its annual report, claims to be socially responsible, does all the right things. In fact, they recently got into a little trouble. Did you read about the news story? This person in Oakland had a copy of The Lion King that they paid for legally on their computer, and they showed it to an elementary school class, and some idiot at Disney sent him a bill for $250 saying, you're not supposed to share private copies with public audiences. And of course, after that, 2 weeks later, Disney said, sorry, we didn't mean to do that. So we let those little things go by because those things happen. You know, it's low person on the totem pole did it. But I'm going to put you on the spot. You now work at Disney, and I've come to you with an investment. This investment is to open, there aren't that many Disney stores left anymore. There used to be hundreds, they've kind of shut them down. But you have a few flagship stores, right? There's one in Times Square, there's one in big cities. More, not to sell stuff, but to kind of act as advertising. So I come to you with a proposal. We should open a new Disney store in the middle of Oakland. Have you been in the middle of Oakland? There's not much there, right? And we want to do it because we want to revitalize some of these inner cities. Or make it Detroit. Let's open it in Detroit, right? A city with shrinking population. We want to bring some life back to the city. And I'm going to cut off all your escape hatches. You know what I mean by that, right? How do you usually rationalize this if you're a company? We'll advertise that we opened a store in Detroit. We'll sell more in other stores. Therefore, it's going to be okay. Let's make this black and white. If you open the store, you're going to lose money. And you're going to lose money forever. Not much money. You're a big company. Let's say you lose $1 million a year. Disney makes a lot. That's like penny change for them. Every time Olaf opens his mouth, $1 million probably spills out in toys and merchandising. But you're going to lose $1 million a year. So first question, since you told me you are socially responsible and you cared about, you know, about helping out society, would you open the store? How many of you would open the store? Nobody? Or one person? I'm going to come back to you. I'm going to turn on the rest of you. And so you told me you were socially responsible. Are you telling me you'll be socially responsible only if it doesn't cost you money? Because what are you saying? I'll be socially responsible if somehow I get side benefits from being socially responsible that exceeds the cost of being socially responsible. In other words, if my value goes up by being socially responsible, I'll be socially responsible. If not, I won't do it. And that basically shows the hypocrisy of this whole process. We want to have our cake and eat it too. We want to be socially responsible without the consequences and the cost, Because we're told if you're socially responsible, your value will go up, everything's going to be okay. Based on what? Nothing. Now I'm going to turn back to you. Because you're the only person who put your mouth where your heart was, right? You said, would you be willing to tell your shareholders that you've done it? Because after all, you have no money. You're investing shareholder money. Would you do it? There's no other ancillary. You have to go in front of them and say, look, guys, we spent this money because we believe in revitalizing inner cities. Would you do it?
Yeah.
This is what I want companies to do. You want to be socially responsible, tell me how much money you're going to spend and don't dance PR games around it. And be open about it because it's not your money. You can be, it's so easy to be charitable with other people's money. And let's face it, that's what CEOs are being charitable with. I'll give away 100. You don't have any money. You're giving away. So if you're Jamie Dimon, don't say, I'm giving $150 million. JP Morgan has no money. It has stockholder money once invested. It has an obligation to bring them in. You're saying, what if they say no? Then don't do it. You're saying, why? Think about what drives them to say no. We talked about how when companies are doing well, people feel rich. If your stock price is up 50%, I can almost guarantee you, you go and say, we're spending $50 million because we believe in uplifting society, nobody's going to blink an eye. But if your stock price is down 90%, are you surprised that they're saying, don't give away my money? You've already given away 90% of my value? I know I'm going to sound morally bankrupt for the next 3 minutes, but I'm okay with that. I'll file Chapter 11 in the morality court when this is all over. But I think the discussion of ESG is completely off the rails. Because here's what I hear when I hear ESG, you know what ESG, right? Environmental, I don't even know why they're all bundled together, why put environmental, social, and governance all together. But it's good versus bad. And here's what we're told, right? If you're a good company, your value will go up. Maybe you will have some short-term consequences, but in the long term, your value will go up. I wish that were true. Because if that were true, I'll have nothing. Basically, you're on my turf, right? What's the objective in corporate finance? Maximize value. And if you've told me that the way to maximize value is by being socially responsible, then we really don't have a problem. You're going to be doing the right thing and in the process increasing value. But is that true? I mean, the other class you know that I teach is a valuation class. And this is something that I'm struggling with and I'm working on, is how do you bring in social responsibility into value? Let me give you the good news if you're a company. Maybe you're a company where being socially responsible will increase value because if you're socially responsible, consumers are more likely to buy your products. If you're L'Oreal, that argument works reasonably well. If you're Ann Taylor, your customers tend to be very conscious, socially conscious. But if you're Walmart, the argument becomes a lot more difficult to make. Because I don't go to Walmart because they're socially conscious products on. It's because stuff is 20% cheaper. Not all companies are going to reap the benefits of being socially responsible in revenues. I'm sorry? Patagonia, Body Shop. I mean, let's face it, you're talking to a subset of a subset of a subset of the population, and that subset might be very conscious. And you're saying, this works for me. So for some companies, it might work out. The argument I've heard is socially responsible companies are less risky. That's actually tough to show. Less risky in what sense? Because if you look at stock prices or earnings, you could actually argue it doesn't show up there. You're saying it's going to show up somewhere. I'll give you potentially the way to bring this in. I think, let's not talk about really good companies. The problem being a company that walks the edge. It's not a bad company, but it walks the edge of good and bad. Is you are risking something catastrophic happening that could bring you down. A few years ago, I valued Valiant. Valiant, as you know, is a Canadian pharmaceutical company that was acquired by value investors And you know what its business strategy was, right? To buy underpriced drugs. I will let that kind of hang out there, right? Underpriced drugs. So these were drugs that were still patent protected, but had been around 8 or 9 or 10 years. They catered usually to a smaller subset of the population, so it was a disease that not everybody had, a subset had. And they were underpriced. Why? Because this particular subgroup needed that drug sometimes to live. And when you need a drug to live, potentially I can charge you a higher price. Think of this as that crazy guy, Martin Tricelli, gone, you know, essentially that was his business model. And he thought he was staying true. He actually quoted me on one of his videos, and I said, please God, do not talk about corporate finance because you've missed the point. And for Valeant, the whole thing came apart in 2017 when their business, all you needed to do was uncover the business model. And people said, really, that's what you do? You buy these drugs and then you increase the price tenfold and then you try to, and because that was their business model. And when it came apart, the stock price collapsed. But here's what happened that had real consequences. Not only the stock price collapsed, nobody would work for them. Scientists said, I'm not working in your R&D department, you're Valeant. So you know what they had to do? They had to rename themselves. They called themselves Bausch & Lomb because that used to be one of the divisions. And when I say Bausch & Lomb, you think contact lens cleaners. You don't think drugs that are overpriced. They destroyed their future as a company because of that catastrophic risk. So what I think we need is a much more honest discussion of what does it mean to be socially conscious? Because if I let you get away with this easy path of if you're socially conscious, it's all going to work out. We know it's not, and the credibility of the argument is going to break down because some company is going to say after 15 years of being socially conscious, when is the payoff coming? This, I think, is going to... So we'll come back to it because we have to talk about being socially conscious. Everybody in this room wants companies to be socially responsible. The question is, do you want to sound good or do you want to do good? And we have to make up our mind on that because right now we've decided sounding good is more important than doing good. And that's not really good enough for me. So let's look at how that utopian world I set up has been shredded, and by me. First, stockholders have little power over managers. We can debate how little the power is, and managers often do what's in their best interest. If you're a bondholder or a bank and you lend money to a firm and you don't protect yourself, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get, come on, you know the word now, Nabisco'd. Managers lie sometimes, and often they shade the truth when they talk to markets. And markets are not exactly rational and cool. The trading room is full of people who are impulsive, doing things on impulse, not rational, cool individuals. And there are social costs, and there could potentially be social benefits. We're in real trouble now, right? The utopian world is gone. And the question is, what... What do we do now? So let me give you basically every linkage is broken down because managerial self-interest dominates stockholder wealth. You've got unprotected debt holders, inefficient markets, and social costs and benefits. So what's your reaction? Let's get rid of this objective. The utopian world is gone. Okay, I'm willing to listen. Let's look at the alternatives. Maybe we can look for a different governance system. You know why you always need a governance system? Somebody's got to keep an eye on managers, right? So if it's not stockholders, tell me who, because you can't just say, hey, somebody will show up. Maybe it'll be the government. Maybe it'll be other managers keeping an eye on these managers. But I have to give you a different corporate governance system. And I'll give you some examples of alternative corporate governance systems that have been out there, and you decide whether this is better than the stockholder-based system that I described in the utopian world. The second is maybe I can pick a different objective. Like what? Instead of maximizing value, I can maximize revenue growth or market share or number of users. I mean, there are these different objectives. Why maximize value? There are these other objectives. We'll come back and look at alternatives and see what can go wrong. With each of these, I'm going to be just as harsh as I was with my own starting objective and say, let's think about what can go wrong, because over time it will. It could be that you return back to maximizing stock prices, but with constraints. Constraints on how much you push this process. And you know what? I'll give you away where I'd like you to end up. All of corporate finance as I know it, at least the way I've written the rest of the notes, is built on the presumption of maximizing stockholder wealth. So if you choose one of the first two, I've got to rewrite the rest of the lecture notes. I don't think I can do it on short notice. So I'm going to try to get you to the third one, but I don't, you know, I'm a realist. Some of you will end up on the first two, and I'm okay with that. So let's pick an alternate corporate governance system. Let's think about the end of the Second World War, 1945. Germany and Japan, as economies, were in complete shambles. There was nothing there. And over the next 40 years, in true economic miracles, those two countries built themselves back up to becoming the second and third largest economies in the world by the mid-80s. And they did it with a very different corporate governance system. Their corporate governance system was not built on stockholder power. It was built on interlocking companies. In Japan, this took the form of kairutsus. Kairutsus are companies that hold shares in each other. So you had 50 or 60 companies all holding shares in each other. In Germany, it took the form usually of a bank in the middle. So in the case of Deutsche was the largest single stockholder in Daimler. Daimler was the largest single stockholder in Allianz. Allianz was the single largest stockholder in Deutsche. So they all held shares. You say, how does this work? If one of the companies was badly managed and badly run in the group, you know what happened? The rest of the group managers would get together and replace the manager of the bad company. It's a very elitist system, if you think about it, because what's the implicit message? Managers went to the right schools, they're smarter people, they're more intelligent at detecting bad management. Why would we let the masses kind of come in and do this for us? So basically, it's a managerial system where managers took care of their own. They shed the worst managers. It's a much less costly system than a stockholder-based system, right? You don't have hostile acquisitions, you know, the side costs from it. And it worked really well for 40 years. In fact, it worked so well that in the mid-80s, Michael Porter, you heard of Michael, right? Harvard Business School strategy guru, said we should all be like the Japanese. He suggested that U.S. companies create their own kairutsus and managers keep an eye on each other. And it sounded good. And then you got to the 1990s and you saw the downside of these systems. So how's the system supposed to work? If you have 60 companies and one company is badly managed and badly run, the remaining 59 get together and replace the 60th manager, right? But let me change the facts a little bit. Let's suppose you have 60 companies and 59 have made bad real estate loans, and one hasn't. So here's my question to you. Is the one guy who did the right thing going to replace the other 59? Or the 59 guys who did the wrong thing say, what's wrong with you? You're not a team player now? That is exactly what happened in Japan in the early 90s. In 1991, Japanese banks and U.S. banks had roughly the same amount of bad real estate loans on their books. In 92, U.S. banks were forced to take a reckoning. Why? Because their shareholders pushed for it. And they were punished. You know, Citibank, at that time Chase, basically every bank saw a drop in value. But they cleaned their books and they moved on. What did Japanese banks do? They said, what problem? We don't see a problem. They're surrounded. Basically, they surrounded the problem, let as little information out, and they hoped it would go away. 30 years later, Japan is still paying a price for not dealing with its problems. The problem with elitist systems is elitist. One of the things I'm going to argue that markets bring to the process is markets have no egos. You know what I mean by no egos? Markets recognize there's a mistake with value, and what happens? The stock price drops 85%. Elitists, on the other hand, when they screw up, hate to admit they screwed up. They might be smart people, they might have gone to the best schools. The Ministry of Finance in Japan attracted the smartest, the brightest people in the system. But just because you're the smartest and the brightest people doesn't mean that their decisions are always going to be smart and bright. And that's exactly what happened in Japan. When you turn your system over to managers, that is a consequence. So remember the utopian? Well, I've shown you two pictures so far, right? I showed you cutthroat corporatism. Think of this as John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie running companies. John D. Rockefeller didn't say, well, what's good for society? What can I do? He said, what do I do to become richer? And you know what? He built, you know, Standard Oil basically as a monopoly. So in managerial corporatism, managers try to essentially, it's essentially all about managers. So here's how it works. The board of directors no longer is there to watch out for shareholder interests. They're there to rubber stamp managers. Whatever managers do, board of directors go along. Lenders and managers are very close relationships. So managers go to the bank, the bankers know the managers. In fact, the bankers might be on the board of directors. It's all very, very, you know, they coexist. Managers buy peace with labor. So basically, they, you know, they say, what will make my life easier? Let's enter a 10-year labor union contract where I offer you 5% more a year for the next 10 years. I'll just pass the cost on to my customers. And in this case, you kind of coexist with your competition. You don't try to be too aggressive. That is so impolite. You say, I have a 17% market share. I'll settle for like 18%. I won't push for 25%. Because that will make my life difficult and create all kinds of frictions. This is essentially about you making your life more comfortable. And in the U.S., from the 1950s through the 1980s, you had managerial corporatism. And it worked really well, right? You know why? Because the system had buffers. When you were GM and you were flush with, you know, there was no, you could afford to do this stuff and get away with it. But it works only if you live in a system with a lot of buffer built into it. If you try to do this today and say, let me enter into a 10-year contract as Walmart and offer 10% more per year, Amazon will eat your lunch and eat the rest of you over 10 years. So managerial corporatism works if you have a system with a lot of buffer built into it. There's an even more skewed version of corporatism that sometimes emerges out of these elitist systems. I call this crony capitalism, crony corporatism. In crony corporatism, remember that government is supposed to be on the other side of the table looking at companies, making sure that society's interests are served? That line is gone in crony. In crony corporatism, the line between companies and governments kind of melt. I won't describe it, but if you're from some countries, you know exactly how crony corporatism works. Because when elections are held, you often see stock prices of some companies shoot up. So what the hell happened there? And it turns out that the person running the company is very close to the party that won. And he said, why would that matter? Only people who are not from that country ask, why would that matter? Because it's a system based on regulations and licenses, and now you have a pathway. So crony corporatism is one of the other options. Is you say, look, you know, I don't want stockholders to run it. Well, you know what? You'll have a group of people, usually a family group or a founding group running the company, and they will take care of their interests, and along the way you might benefit, but only accidentally. So if you want to go down a different corporate governance route, think through the process. Remember we said power abhors the vacuum? If stockholders don't have power, somebody else has it. And you have to ask, are they benign or are they malignant? Because I can create malignant versions of almost every power group. So if you want to pick on stockholders, I'll give you anecdotal evidence on, you know, crony corporatism and managerial corporatism gone right. I know anecdotal evidence shouldn't do, but somebody's running the company. The power lies somewhere, and you have to ask, am I comfortable with that system? Let's pick a different objective. Objective that I picked was maximizing value. It wasn't maximizing earnings. Often people beat up on corporate finance saying, you're all about earnings next year. That is actually not consistent with value. When I valued Tesla last week, I think that to maximize their value, they should actually give up on earnings now and give up on cash flows now. Because the way they maximize value is by becoming a really big auto company, which means they've got to build more assembly plants. So don't talk to me about positive earnings and cash flows, because that is actually not consistent with maximizing value. But there are other objectives we could have picked. The Japanese companies we talked about in the mid-80s, their objective was to maximize market share. And when Japanese companies succeeded, other companies around the world said, maybe we should maximize market share as well. Now, when you pick one of these objectives, I call these intermediate objectives. Because market share by itself is a stupid objective. And here's why. Would you want 100% market share of your market? You're saying, yes, that'll be great. But what if to get that, you have to sell everything below cost? Who wants 100% market share if you're going to lose money forever? In the early 1980s, American Airlines got a new CEO, a guy called Robert Crandall. And when he came in his first press conference, here's what he said. I want to make American the number one domestic U.S. airline. Number one domestic U.S. airline. So he stated his objective, right? And by 1989, he'd succeeded. American was the number one domestic U.S. airline in terms of number of passengers flown. But there were only two airlines in 1989 making money, and neither was called American. One was Southwest Air. And you know what they did then? They flew from Houston to Dallas and back again, back. Because they made money on that route. They said, hey, we're not interested in flying from L.A. to New York unless we know how to make money. The exact opposite of a market share argument. The other was Alaska Air, because nobody else wanted to fly to Fairbanks, I guess. Another niche airline. If you focus on maximizing revenue growth or market share, you know what? You will succeed because the message will go down the ranks that it's all about market share. Everybody's going to do things based on market share. And you're going to wake up one day and say, what the hell have we created here? Let's call this the movie pass endgame. Do you want market share? Yeah. Sell stuff for way below it costs you. So when people said, MoviePass had 3 million members, shouldn't we reward them for that? I said, what do you think would happen if Starbucks offered, drink all the cappuccinos you want for $10 a month? Would they get a lot of people signing up? I don't even drink that many Starbucks, but that's 2 cappuccinos a month. I think I can do that. They'll have millions of people sign up, but to what end? It terrifies me when I look at these young companies today focused on subscribers and users and members. I'm not saying they don't matter, but you need to think through the consequences. How does it play out in value? It might not happen till the future, but if you don't have a business plan to connect users to value, it's not going to happen accidentally. So if you pick a different objective, an intermediate objective, think through what it means in terms of how people will act. Or maybe you want to maximize stakeholder wealth. Remember all the stakeholders? This sounds good, right? Because you take care of stockholders and bondholders and lenders and society. And the problem with stakeholder wealth is you try to keep multiple groups happy and they have different objectives. So it sounds good. And what triggered this part, this was a slide I added on for this semester, because the business roundtable, and this was a few, this was the weekly puzzle that I gave you for the week, put out a missive, and the business roundtable is actually composed of CEOs of some of America's largest companies. And they basically wrote what I call, essentially, how when you get defeated, you sign saying, I'll give up this, So basically, I don't know what, they were under lots of pressure, so they're feeling people breathing down their necks, I guess. And they hired Jamie Dimon to write. He was actually the person who headed the message writing. Terrible messenger. Terrible message. Why terrible messenger? Asking Jamie Dimon to talk about how much he cares about shareholders is completely incongruous. This is a guy who insisted that he was going to be both chairman and CEO of the same company at the same time. He has a history of doing what's right for Jamie Dimon. Obviously, I will never be invited back to J.P. Morgan, but I really don't care. Right? But it's not shareholders. And they listed out what they were going to do as companies, and it sounded so good. They said, we're going to take care of labor and give them a livable wage. We're going to take care of society and make their own social cause. We're going to take care of essentially every group was kind of dealt with. You're saying, why not? This sounds good. I'm going to call this confused corporatism, because this is what will happen. Because now, put yourself in the shoes
of a manager in the company and trying to make a decision on whether to build a factory.
You've taken away the old rules, right? It's not about cash flows and maximizing value. It's about keeping all these groups happy, right? How the heck do you make a decision? Whose interests are you going to serve on this decision? And within that same company, there could be 100 decision makers, and each has a different objective, and they're all pulling in different directions. This is one thing I can guarantee. Entities which don't have a central focus can be filled with the smartest people, but they're all going to end up in the same place, which is a ditch. You want stakeholder wealth maximization? Here's where you're going to end up. You're going to end up looking like a... remember the old government-owned companies? Many of the people who used to work at government-owned companies and I knew were bright people. But here's the problem. They had no idea what the mission was. So on one day it was hire more people because that's your focus. The next day it was, hey, make sure you make a lot of product because we want to look like we're turning out more output. And you went, you cycled through objective after objective. And after a while he said, I have no idea what I'm doing. I'll focus on whatever will make my immediate superior happier. Have any of you worked in nonprofits? Okay. If you work in a nonprofit, one of my biggest problems with nonprofits is they have a mission statement with 10 things you're supposed to do. Already you've lost the game, right? Because you're sitting there saying, which of these 10 things matters the most? Give me your focus. If you really want stakeholder wealth maximization, you know what you're going to end up like? NYU. Any research university. What's the mission you think of a university? What should it be? Education, right? I've worked at universities for 35 years. On any given day, I don't even know what the mission is. Is the mission to protect research faculty? Sometimes you think that's what it is because the entire university. Is it to protect the site? And it's essentially shifts from moment to moment. And what do you have? You have complete chaos in decision making. I'm going to say something that's going to get me into terrible trouble. That's why I don't give money to universities. Because I have no idea what your mission is. You might build the biggest gym known to man, and that's become your end mission. I want to build a gym for you. You know, somewhere along the way, that became the end game. And you know what happens when you have an entity with mixed missions? Nobody's happy. Are you guys as students, you know, feeling that you're paying too little in tuition? Every person in this room have asked you, do you think you're paying too much? Unless you're absurdly wealthy and you've lost all sense of money. It's like, $200,000 for an MBA is way too much. So students feel they're being overcharged. You walk around this university and ask faculty, do you feel you're paid well? They say, oh no, I think I'm underpaid for working 4.5 hours a week for 30 weeks. Yeah, but that we won't go there, no? Go to the administrative staff. See, do you feel, and they said, no, the people keep asking me to do things that are not in my job description. You know what I have a session I do on what I call the disruption dilemma. And I talk about how do you know what kinds of companies or businesses are going to get disrupted? And one of the things I look for is everybody in this business unhappy? And if the answer is yes, you're ripe for disruption. You think, why hasn't it happened in the university, in the university business, the education business? Because inertia is the strongest force known to mankind. Can you imagine being a 21-year-old going or 18-year-old going to your parents? You've done really well in high school. Say, look, you know what? I'm going to skip this 4-year university. I think it's a scam. I think I can pick up what I need in a year and a half of online classes. What do you think your parents will do? Or what would you do if your kids came and told you that? Forget about how long inertia lasts. Your problem is that, no, no, no. You have to go through a 4-year education. The system is set up for this. I kind of agree with you, but go. It's a disruption might be slow to come, but this cannot stand. This is a business model that's at war with itself because it doesn't have a focus. So whenever somebody says stakeholder wealth maximization, think university. It'll bring you back to earth. in terms of what happens when you don't have a central mission. So you know what? I've tried to make a sales pitch to get you back to where I want you to be.
I want you to think about maximizing value and perhaps even stock prices, but in a constrained way. Constrained in what sense? I think my biggest sales pitch for maximizing stock prices, a market-based system, is it's self-correcting. Self-correcting in what sense? What do we say managers do? They overreach. They do what's in their best interest, and they put stockholders in the back seat. And if you do that enough, I'm going to show you the kind of pushback you get from markets. Your lenders, you don't protect yourself, you get Nabisco. We'll talk about what happens. How do markets push back when they get Nabisco? You lie to financial markets. The truth eventually comes out. And when that comes out, we'll see the pushback from markets on what happens if you take advantage of them. And if you're a company that walks at the edge, I'm going to argue that eventually you're going to see a pushback that's going to cost you a lot more than what you thought you were making by walking close to the edge. So let's start with the stockholder backlash. If you're a stockholder in a company and managers put their interests above you, it pisses you off, right? And they keep doing it, you get more and more pissed off. There's a critical mass of piss off where you finally do something about it. And here's what happens when you hit that critical mass. First, you see some institutional investors become more activist. Activists in what sense? Rather than selling and moving on, they actually stand and fight. It's rare. I'm not talking BlackRock activism. I don't trust Larry Fink further than I can throw him. So when he talks it, I listen and say, really? I'll believe it when I see it. So he talks a good game. He doesn't seem to carry it through. I'm talking CalPERS activism as in the 80s and the 90s, where they listed out the 10 worst managed companies in the US, and then they took a position in these companies, they pushed for change. But institutions are never going to be the front line of activism. Because as I said, activism requires unpleasant people saying unpleasant things. And if you have other fish to fry, if you're Fidelity and you're already managing that company's pension funds, and you don't want to risk that relationship. So you have activist individuals. They often hide behind names that you might not recognize. So the Carl Icahns, the Bill Ackmans, the Ron Perlmans of the world, essentially show up. And their skill is not so much that they know corporate finance and value. Their skill is in targeting. I tell people, look, Carl Icahn is not the deepest thinker on the face of the earth. Here's his typical pitch. He goes to a company and says, you have too much cash, give me the cash. You look at every Carl Icahn pitch, that's pretty much it, right? You boil it down, you have too much cash, give me the cash. You say, how did this guy get to be worth billions? Because he picks the right companies. What are those companies? Companies where stockholders have hit that critical mass. So when he says, you have too much cash, give me the cash. You know what the stockholders do? They say, yes, yes, give the cash back. We don't trust you. But it happens because you've lost the battle for trust on your shareholders. And sometimes in these companies, shareholders actually start to speak up. So stockholder meetings actually become rowdy affairs because nobody's happy. So if you think about this process, it plays out, and the ultimate penalty you pay when you take advantage of stockholders is eventually you get targeted. Now, when you look at Wall Street movies about hostile takeovers, it's usually a good company run by a great manager taken over by this nasty individual. If you want to see typecasting at play, you know, one of the movies you should see is Other People's Money. It's an old movie, but already you see the typecasting. Other People's Money is about a phone cable company in New England that's being acquired in a hostile acquisition. So most of Wall Street movies, the bad guy loses, the good guy wins, and you make phone cable for the rest of eternity. But this movie is actually different because it accepts shades of gray. But it does it within Hollywood's own rules. So you know who the hostile acquirer is, right? Has anybody seen the movie? Danny DeVito. So that is corporate finance, Danny DeVito. Right? The phone company CEO was Gregory Peck. Gregory, distinguished gray hair. You know, you've seen Gregory Peck in some movie or the other. If you get a chance, watch the movie.
There's your typecast. There's corporate finance. There's the anti-corporate finance. Who would you rather be? But this movie plays out in a way that you don't expect with Hollywood. It actually plays out. It ends with an annual meeting. That's the climax. You think this is a terrible movie. I'm not. It's actually a fun annual meeting because Danny DeVito gets there. Everybody boos him. And then he says, you can boo me as much as you want. You think I'm killing your company, but you're being killed by fiber optics. You're just making cable in a business where nobody wants cable. And sometimes we take it out on the messenger. This case, if you think about good companies, it's not good companies that get targeted in hostile acquisitions. It's companies that have done badly. In what sense? They delivered earnings much lower than their peer group. Their return on equity is much lower. Their stock price has done badly. You almost never see a target company targeted after its stock price has gone up 70%. It's usually when it's down 50%. And here's why. In every hostile acquisition, you have a fight between two groups. The first is the income, and you're the shareholder. And for once in your life, you're the focus of attention. And what do the incumbent managers tell you as a shareholder? Don't sell to that guy. He's a bad guy. He's going to ruin the company. And what does the acquirer say? Don't trust the managers. They're going to screw you over. And you get to decide who to trust. And I'll tip the scales. Your stock's been down 60% over the last 5 years. Your earnings have been terrible. Who are you going to trust? Not surprisingly, hostile acquisitions succeed more often when you have companies that have a history of delivering bad performance. So when you think about laws that try to restrict hostile acquisitions, and in the U.S., actually, Pennsylvania tried to pass a law saying no hostile acquisitions, designed to protect one company in Pennsylvania that was being targeted. And there are countries where hostile acquisitions are still not allowed because they're viewed as bad things. You know who you protect when you ban hostile acquisitions? Not good managers at good companies, but primarily managers that are running badly run companies, badly managed companies. That's who you protect when you say, no more hostile acquisitions. The threat of an impending execution is often what focuses your mind. See, even if a hostile acquisition does not work, it forces man to say, hey, maybe we should change our ways and try to do a little better. So that's a stockholder backlash. And when you have the stockholder backlash, boards start to get more responsive. And you're starting to see that, actually, in companies where you see more of an activist pushback, is the boards get smaller. Remember that 17-person board starts to get smaller. Second, there are fewer insiders on the boards because now it's not because you don't want insiders, but because you don't want to piss off the shareholders anymore. They might sell to the acquirer. Directors are starting to have shares in the company, even though it's a very, very, very steep climb. They get 1,000 shares, 2,000 shares. You're still thinking more like a director. And there are more committees now which come up with new directors. So basically, at least the semblance of independence shows up. But it doesn't happen because one day benign management accepts that we should be more responsive. It's because they're scared. So let me go back to Disney. Remember the 1997 board that I showed you for Disney, the ultimate rubber stamp board? At that time, Eisner was an imperial CEO, and there was a reason he acquired power. And this is something that needs to be told in the story as well. I told you that Michael Eisner came to Disney from Paramount in 1986, and Disney was in real trouble. And for the first decade, he was the right CEO for Disney. He did the right things. He made the right. He brought Disney out from the muck and made it a successful company again. And that's how he became an imperial CEO. The problem, though, is, like all human beings, when you succeed, it goes to your head and you think that everything you do will succeed. And in 96, he did a big acquisition of Cap Cities ABC. Okay. And the acquisition did really badly. In hindsight, the only reason the acquisition has worked is something that got thrown into that acquisition as an afterthought. A small piece of Cap Cities ABC became the most successful cash flow part for Disney. You know what that small part was? What did ABC have in 96? Tiny piece of ABC. ESPN. It wasn't even part of the negotiation. In fact, if ABC had said, can we keep ESPN back? And Eisner would have said, who would ever watch 24 hours of sports day after day after day? I mean, they obviously, my second son could watch that 30 minutes over and over for the whole 24 hours and be okay with it. And between 97 and 2000, Disney went through problem after problem. Remember your stock on Disney, pissed off, still more pissed off. And in fact, by 2003, Disney was in real trouble. It had lost half its market cap. The ABC deal, they were showing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire over and over again. That's the only show people seem to watch on the network. And the company was in trouble. In fact, remember we said a hostile acquisition is the ultimate threat? In 2004, Comcast announced the most insulting hostile acquisition of all time. And here's why it was insulting. Usually when you try to acquire a company, what do? You take the market price and you offer a premium, right? You know what Comcast did? They took the market price and they offered a discount. Which means you were really not serious about this hostile acquisition. What you were saying is, your stockholders, Michael Eisner, hate you so much that they will sell the shares to me at a discount. It didn't quite work out, but it woke up Disney. It woke up the board, it woke up the management. And they, so when you look at the board, he changed the board, he had fewer insiders. His personal lawyer, remember the guy? Is now gone, saying that was a little bit over the line. A little more independent, and he also started to do things in the essence of corporate governance, right? So he had more, he stepped away from the chairman of the board. He made George Mitchell the chairman of the board. Basically, he did all the cosmetic things. But remember why he did them? He didn't do it because he felt the urge to have better corporate governance. It's because he was scared. But it wasn't enough for the board. Finally, that board that had rubber stamped him said, "You got to go." And if you think about what drove him out of Disney, it was the fact that the board finally said, we can't defend you anymore. The cannibals, the barbarians are at the gate. They're going to break through and come after us. So you got to go. So the board picked a guy called Bob Iger to replace him. And often when you think about shifts in power, often you pick the opposite of whoever you're replacing if you've had a bad time. In this case, they took Eisner and said, let's pick the anti-Eisner. Eisner, of course, big ego, huge. They picked a guy who is very self-effacing. So they said, no. And he behaved very well initially. He made the board smaller. He made it more independent. He did all the right things. In fact, by 2010, Disney was ranked as the best company in terms of corporate governance among entertainment companies. This is Disney, so you're saying, this is a happy ending, let's stop there, the prince kisses the princess, they go off into the sunset, but it didn't end that way. In fact, in 2011, Iger did the best possible thing a CEO can do. He said, look, I've been CEO long enough, we've got to prepare for a succession. He said he was going to step down and gave Disney, 3 years, and so groom a successor. And, so far we're on script, right? This is a happy ending. And, you think, this Disney is set for life. And here's where the board made their fatal mistake. And Iger went along. In 2015, the Disney board went to Iger and said, you shouldn't step down. Why? You're so critical to the company that if you step down, the company won't do well. Have you ever seen Julius Caesar, the Shakespeare version? The first time he's offered the crown, he says, no, I'm not worthy of it. The second time, no, that's too big a responsibility. The third time, okay, put it on my head. Iger, after initially saying, no, I'm not that important. Oh, maybe I'm a little important. Oh, okay. And in the process, he set off a chain reaction. Because there was a whole hierarchy of management waiting for his, moving on. So the person who had been considered the heir apparent, Thomas Stagg, said, I'm not waiting around. And he left. There was a vacuum. Basically, the three people right below who had been lined up, they said, I'm not waiting around, they left. Left a vacuum there. That vacuum hasn't been filled. In fact, in 2019, Disney made another big decision, right? To buy News Corp, the portion of Fox, which is, you know, the not the news, but the rest of Fox. Huge investment, $70 billion acquisition. And now they're stuck because they don't have a second level management. And this is going to be Disney's big challenge. Because even though the board might not want to make Iger step down, mortality will take care of that issue. Sooner or later, you need a second level. I'm not saying he's going to die in the ranks or something. Maybe I am, you know. But I'm saying you, at some point in time, you have to think about transitions. And the so when you have bad corporate governance, there are all kinds of spillover effects. You know? If you want to see a truly toxic effect of corporate governance, take a look at Viacom. Okay? This is what happens when corporate governance. So I'm not going to fill the rest of the story because it is like it's like a horror story unfold of what happens when you have two classes of shares and you concede power because you think somebody, I'll tell you the story. The guy who ran Viacom, who built it up as a superstar company, was a guy called Sumner Redstone. And Sumner Redstone was viewed as an incredible, you know, he knew the business. So in the 80s and the 90s, when people talked about, hey, that guy's a genius. So when he said, I'm going to introduce two classes of shares and I'm going to keep the voting rights, you know what people's reaction was, right? He's Sumner Redstone, he's a smart guy, what's the problem? So you could see the same story play out with Mark Zuckerberg in a younger form. But basically, this is the basis for giving up power. Hey, this guy is a smart guy. So you see this layer with Brin and Page at Google. Smart people, what's the problem? No. What you're expecting is a Singapore-style power usage, which is the person running the power really doesn't care, so like Lee Kuan Yew, they'll do the right things. But that's a benign dictatorship. The problem with benign dictatorship is sometimes benign dictators become malignant dictators, and then what are you going to do? In the case of Viacom, what happened was Sumner got older and older and older, surprise. And he got to a point where people weren't sure whether he was still quite there. In fact, you know, mentally he seemed to have, you know. But the problem is his voting shares went to his daughter, who now runs effectively the company through those voting shares. And it's creating incredible dysfunction in the company. Because at any point in time, you know, you don't know whose interest. There are lawsuits flying around, people getting displaced. An investor saying, what happened here? What happened here was you gave up power and now you have no way of getting change happen because you've given up the power to an incumbent who might not be working in your best interest. So when you think about Disney today, this is the big challenge. Is who's the next CEO? And that debate is still going on. Should we bring in somebody from the outside? Should we groom somebody from the inside? And until that debate is played out, you're going to see the consequences play out. Now, of course, your reaction is, why don't we just pass laws requiring good corporate governance? That was Sarbanes-Oxley, right? We will legislate good corporate governance. That's like legislating good democracy. So here's what I'm going to legislate. Voters have to be informed. I will send you pamphlets to make sure you get informed. And I will pass all kinds of laws requiring everybody to vote. Therefore, the decision you make will be a sensible decision. Lots of breakdowns in that process, right? The pamphlet I send you might never be read. You might still vote for randomly on that day or vote for somebody you don't even know. No. You can't legislate good corporate governance. The problem with legislation is it's a bludgeon. Right? You're going to write laws for the worst among us. You're going to say you have to do this, this, and this. And that's what, if you get a chance, I was going to say read Sarbanes-Oxley, but that is torture. It's like 1,000 pages long. Just take a look at the bullet points in Sarbanes-Oxley. It's what I call checkbox corporate governance. And it's in fact how many companies and many services measure corporate, you know, how big is your board? How many insiders do you have? Was your nominating committee independent? So you go check, 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 check. And if you have all the checks, you're a company with good corporate governance. I can have all the checks checked off and have a terrible Lehman had a board that followed Sarbanes-Oxley. Fat lot of good that did for them. So when I hear countries saying we're going to legislate good corporate governance, I don't think it's going to work. And in fact, I want good corporate governance. You know why? Because there is a payoff to corporate governance. It is small, so I'm not going to oversell you on it. Companies that have better corporate governance tend to trade at higher prices than companies with bad corporate governance. Countries with good corporate governance see higher market prices for stocks than companies with bad corporate governance. You know why? Because you made change possible. It's not some magical board is smaller, that's why. It's because you made change possible. In a country where corporate governance is dead in the water, you're stuck with the status quo. And that's not a good place to be. So if I'm going to make a pitch for corporate governance, is if you think every company is already run right, then by all means, I don't care about corporate governance. Managers are good people, they do the right thing, therefore it's okay. If you believe that change is the constant we face, especially in a world of disruption, that companies need to change the way, then you've got to think about how you bring in that corporate governance, because without it, it's not going to happen. Now let's talk about bondholders. What happens if you don't protect yourself? You get ripped off, right? The Nabisco example. You know what happened post-Nabisco? Bond markets learned their lesson. They said, we're not going to just buy bonds from you and have no protections, even though you're well-known. We're going to put in protections. In fact, many bonds issued post-1987, which is when the Nabisco disaster happened, were puttable bonds. You're saying, what are puttable bonds? You buy a bond by a company. If it's a puttable bond, it comes with legal restrictions, which is if I do something stupid, like a leverage buyout, you put the bond back to me, you get your face value back. Remember what killed you in Nabisco, you were stuck with an old interest rate while the company changed. With puttable bonds, I'm protecting you. Bonds became convertible bonds as well, more convertible bonds. Why? Because if you try to rip me off too much as an equity investor, I'll become one of you. Then who are you going to rip off? You're saying it's too late to protect me on Nabisco. You're absolutely right, but it protected you on the next generations of ripper offers. And this might be, again, you learn lessons with each generation that you build in. But at least you're learning and building it in. And with financial markets, we know what happens. When companies that lie, the truth comes out. You know, you see the scandals. Like, what is the essence of an accounting scandal? The essence of an accounting scandal is you've been cooking the books for a while and it's blown up on you. It always does. Eventually it does. And when it does, the first level reaction is what? The stock price drops, right? Which is bad enough. But you know what? It stays down. Why? Because you've lost trust in management. We forget how much of value is built on trust. Why? Because remember those growth assets? What am I basing it on? What you tell me you will do in the future, right? And if you undercut your credibility, why would I ever believe you? I've never understood why growth companies play accounting games. I'm not condoning mature companies playing it, but at least in some weird way I can understand, you know, if I've cooked the books, I'm a mature company, I report a higher earnings, maybe there's a payoff. But if you're a growth company and you play accounting games, think of how much you're putting at risk because you want to report a 5 cent higher earnings per share. That's what I never understood about Groupon when it went public. Groupon, young company, goes public and starts playing accounting games right off the top. They said, no, we're not losing money. Are you going to believe us or those financial statements we give you? We're actually making money. What? All those customer acquisition costs are really not operating expenses. We'll just add them back. Adjusted EBITDA. You know what adjusted EBITDA, right? Basically, you take the EBITDA and start adding stuff until it gets really positive. That's what adjusted is. Add back stock-based compensation. Why? No, let's make it more. It's a device that these young companies play, and I don't understand that game. I am not buying Casper because of its adjusted EBITDA. So why are you playing games, acting as if you make money? I know you lose money. You know you lose money. Let's start with that as a base. Now tell me what you plan to do to make money. The problem with playing games with financial markets is eventually the truth comes out and then your credibility is shot. You can announce every plan you want, but nobody believes you. And finally, if you walk close to the edge and you create large social costs. Even though you might be on the right side of the law, eventually something bad happens. Right? With Exxon Mobil, it might have been Valdez. With British Petroleum, it might have been the one in the Gulf of Mexico. But with oil companies, my reaction is there, but for the grace of God, goes everybody else. So when people pick on a particular oil company, you drill for oil in an ocean, you are going to create a disaster sooner or later. You know? So it's almost a given in the business. But take Vale, one of my companies, right? Vale is a mining company. By itself, already with mining, you're at the wrong side of the societal good-bad phenomenon because it's tough to be a really good mining company. You can try, but you still have to dig and create environmental damage. But Vale, a couple of years ago, had a real problem which went beyond the mining, which is in Brazil, I think, one, because in the process of mining, they had these dams they had built to keep the water out, and they weren't looking at one of the dams. But thousands of people died. Now we're talking not just a human tragedy, but we're talking a cost that's going to follow you now for pretty much. Vale has been contaminated, perhaps forever, because it didn't take care of the... So while it was doing it, it probably said, well, let's not spend more money on the dam. It's just additional cost. Our earnings will look much better. Maybe you had higher earnings for a few years because you did it. But in hindsight, it was a terrible decision. It cost you more in terms of value than whatever you gained. This is why I think this is the argument to be made for social responsibility. Is you have less, you probably have lower earnings as a going concern, but you save yourself the penalty that will come when you cross the line. So when you look at tobacco companies, think about how much of a penalty they face because they're viewed as bad companies. You could target tobacco companies, you could charge them higher taxes, and nobody comes to their protection because they're bad companies. The one comparative advantage they've gained is they know how to operate as bad companies. It requires a skill set, right? Because you got to be able to walk that line. And that's why I think they were supremely well positioned to buy some cannabis companies. They said, no, we know exactly what's coming down the pike at you, and we're prepared for that. We already have the legal teams. We know exactly what we need to file. Vaping is this intermediate place to be. I'm not even sure. You know, so in a sense, when you're in a business that you know already you're on the wrong end, you are playing with fire. And in a sense, that is a consequence built in when you think about, hey, should I take that extra step? So if you trust markets to play out, this is how, so think of this as maybe a quasi-utopian world, because you're assuming that markets do the work for you. Managers will get more responsive to stockholders because they're afraid of activist investors. Lenders will get protected because they will learn and build it into the bonds. Companies will not lie as much to financial markets because they're afraid of the potential price they have to pay. And companies will constrain themselves in terms of social costs because they know that if they kind of go to the extremes, bad things can happen to them. I call this constrained corporatism. So if you want, compare this to the cutthroat corporatism. And what I do is I don't maximize my value by doing everything I can legally can. I go as far as I can where I think I'm not creating these. So in constrained corporatism, I take at least, I'm not going to say take care of the different, I consider those stakeholder groups. Okay. And if you've ever worked at a company, this is exactly what happens in a sensible company in terms of decision making. You don't do the Martin Tricelli thing of let's charge $50,000 for a dose because I can get away with it, because you know that it might increase your revenues this year, but it's going to cost you long term. You bring in those constraints. The debate we should be having is where those constraints should come from. Right? That's really it. If you're a pure market believer, what are you saying? Let markets take care of it. The constraints will come in. I am a realist. I don't think markets are capable of bringing in all those constraints. I think for some of these constraints, you need governments to step in. So there is an argument to be made that governments need strong environmental laws, because if you don't, or need to bring in Because if you don't, the worst among us are going to gain at the expense of the best among us, because, you know. So I think that's where the debate should be. Should we maximize every, because that's a pipe dream. You're not going to maximize everybody's wealth. Let's talk about how these constraints come in and which ones are better left to markets and which ones require external intervention. And I would say less is more when it comes to external intervention. Now, whether it's the SEC or whether it's governments, now I think, because when you try to do too much here, the side costs you create are actually greater, because there's a law of unintended consequences. You know that U.S. companies increasingly moved to stock options in the 90s, right? Many companies. You know why they moved to stock options? Because in 1992, Congress passed a law putting a cap on executive pay. For the best of intentions, executives get paid too much in companies, we're going to put a cap. But in 92, because they didn't even know options were really a big, they made the law entirely in terms of what's your pay, what's your bonus. And guess what companies did? If the law is written in terms of that, we're going to give options, which created a whole set of side costs for the next 20 years. So should we have constraints? Absolutely. The question of where those constraints come in on each of these dimensions is what we should be talking about. So I'm not going to say minimum wage laws are bad, because in a sense, that might be a constraint we need. The only problem is if you're a company in a global environment and you have minimum wage laws in one country, you still have to think through what does that mean in terms of how you compete in a global market. I'm not saying the answer is don't have, but I'm saying when you talk about constraints, that's effectively what you're talking about, is where do those constraints come from. So I'm going to let you decide for yourselves. I mean, I made a very hard pitch, so I'm not going to, you know, deny that I have a bias in this end game. But I want you to think about what you think the end game should be for a company. Should it be to maximize stock prices with no restraints? Maybe you're a John D. Rockefeller reincarnated, saying this is all bad, which is just focus. You're like Al Dunlap. Have you heard of Al Dunlap? Al Dunlap was a CEO who made his reputation, a company called Scott Paper. He came in, and Scott Paper was a company that had significant cost problems. He came in and cut costs. He turned the company around, got a reputation as a turnaround CEO. This is a bad problem, because you get a reputation as a turnaround CEO. Guess what happens? The next company that gets into trouble, the board says, we need a turnaround CEO. Next company that got in trouble was Sunbeam, a company which did not have a cost-cutting problem, but had a strategic problem. Guess who they hire? Al Dunlap. Al Dunlap doesn't have a strategic bone in his body. So guess what he does when he comes into Sunbeam? He cuts costs. This is a one-trick pony. Al Dunlap wrote a book saying this, all this thing about taking care of other groups is ridiculous. If it's legal, I can do it. And my objective is to maximize stock prices. Therefore, if it's legal, I will do whatever is legal to maximize stock prices. Think of that as, you know, so you're maybe an Al Dunlap, you know, follower, and that's fine. That's your, maybe you should maximize stock prices with constraints, and you have to decide whether the constraint should come from markets, in which case you've got to give markets time to fix it. Or you might say that will take too much time and markets are not that good, and I'm going to step in, but be specific about which groups you're going to protect with your regulations and laws. Maybe your objective should be to maximize firm value, because bondholders are not protected, that you need to protect, you know, bondholders and banks, and that you shouldn't let stockholders run the rules. In which case, you need to have on the board of directors, directors who represent the bank. And sometimes it happens, right? The bank, but you will force it. Or maybe it's something else. Maybe you think what MoviePass did was the right thing to do. Go for users first. Worry about value afterwards. Your own version of Beat 'em up Bruce, you know. And say, but here's why your choice matters. What you pick will determine how much you agree or disagree with me for the next 14 weeks. And I'm perfectly okay with it. So when I talk about picking projects, you know what I'm going to say? Pick projects with positive net present value. And what's the sales pitch you make for picking? If you do that, your value will go up. And in my world, that makes complete sense. But if you think that the objective for a company should be to maximize market share or maximize growth, you might say, no, that's not what I'm going to look for. When I look at a project, I'm going to see how much growth it adds to my revenues. And that I want to be clear about why we will disagree from this point on. It's not because you disagree with the mechanics of what I might do with net present value or discount rates. It's because you're disagreeing with what the end game is. So be clear for yourself at least as to where that disagreement comes from. Because I don't think one size fits all. I think there are some markets where I would say, go out and maximize stock price with constraints, and I'm okay with it. In the U.S., I think I'm comfortable with the maximum. But if you're in Poland, and I say, should I maximize stock price, or in Sri Lanka, and you say maximize, I'm a little more leery because these are less liquid markets driven by insiders, and you could maximize stock prices by manipulating the stock price by putting in an order. So there I might say, you know what, maximize stockholder wealth. Don't worry about stock prices. And if you're in a world where bankers and bondholders are not protected, the laws are either not there, the legal system takes forever. Remember, there are two ways the legal system fails. One is they don't follow the law. The second is it takes forever. Either way, you're not going to get what's right, what's due to you. You might pick maximizing firm value. So make your pick because it's going to drive everything else we do. Any questions? Yes. Okay, does somebody want to answer the question? What's the difference between maximizing stock price and maximizing stockholder wealth? What's the stock price? It's a market's assessment of stockholder wealth, right? If you believe markets are efficient, the two will converge. If you believe markets are manipulated, run by insiders, they're short-term, the two could diverge. Which puts you in a bad place, right? Because you could go out and maximize stockholder wealth and your stock price could drop. And I'm saying, don't worry about it. You did the right thing. The only problem is your shareholders might just punish you and get rid of you. 5 years later, you can say, I told you so, but you've lost your job already. So when you think about stockholder wealth and stock prices, that's the key differential. What do you think about markets? So take this back to every other class you have, because this discussion is playing out in marketing. It's playing out, of course, in ESG. And I'm not saying take my viewpoint, but take a viewpoint that kind of looks at the big picture. Because otherwise, you're letting the purists drive this discussion, saying this is the right thing to do. Do it, and everything will be okay. Take it on faith. We can't take things on faith because we're building an entire system on this. We have to be careful we're not building in something that is a bad endgame, because then everything else will flow from that. So now let's talk about the hurdle rate. You're saying it's only 8 minutes. 8 minutes is a lifetime. I'm not letting you go with 8 minutes left. Okay? So let's talk about hurdle rates. Remember the sub-principle? What did I say? The hurdle rate should be higher for riskier investments and lower for safer investments, right? And should reflect the mix of. So for the next 7 or 8 sessions, that's all we're going to talk about. And to get this discussion going, let me set up how I think about hurdle rates. For me, when I think about the hurdle rate in a project, I'm going to start with a base, which is an absolute minimum below which I cannot earn. A risk-free rate, right? If you can make 1.92% risk-free investing in T-bonds, you definitely should not even be looking at projects that make less than 1.92%. Everybody agree with that? Because if you don't agree with that, we need to get that nailed down, right? Now, the question is, how much of a risk premium should you add on that 1.92%? And that's really the debate we should have. And then, to answer that question, I need to answer 2 sub-questions. First is, what is risk? You see, I know that already. I took the foundations class. That might be a problem, because we've already contaminated how you think about risk. Yeah, you think standard deviation, volatility. Let that all go. We're going to start with that. What is risk? And then I'm going to ask a follow-up question. How do we measure that risk and bring it into a hurdle rate, convert into premium? So let's start with that first question. What is risk? Let me open that to the class. What is risk? I've already, contaminated the discussion by saying don't use standard deviation of volatility or beta. What is risk? Anybody want to try? What is risk? Yes. Volatility of an expected. You've been in finance a little too long, right? Because in a sense, that's what after a class is standard deviation, volatility. Yeah. When I think about risk and investment, that's not what, the risk is the feeling in the pit of my stomach. When a stock I own a big chunk of drops 15% and there's nothing I can do about it. Until you felt it, risk is an abstraction. So it's true, we measure risk with volatility or standard deviation, but let's talk about what is risk? What is it that we're trying to measure?
I want to start with it. I don't agree with it, but I'm going to start with the definition, because what's he defined risk as?
Risk is bad things could happen to you,
which is intuitive, right? I mean, we don't sit around saying, oh, lots of good things happened. It's a risk. Nobody complains about a stock going up threefold saying that was a risky stock. We don't think about upside risk. We think about downside. But the problem with that definition of risk, defining risk as a bad thing, is you know where it's going to lead you, right? If risk is a bad thing, what should we all do? We should avoid it. You've given a definition of risk that every risk hedging guy loves. Because here's what I'm going to do. I'm saying, you want to hedge exchange rate risk? I have a product for you. You want to make your earnings more stable? I have an acquisition you can do. It's a very dangerous place to be because of what it leads to. Risk is neither good nor bad. I'm glad nobody said risk is uncertainty. This is the kind of dance that economists do. Uncertainty, risk, risk. You basically replace one nebulous word with another nebulous word, and you move back and forth between the two. I'll give you my favorite definition of risk, and it's the Chinese symbol for crisis. Let me tell you as a prequel that I know no Chinese. This could be a gigantic hoax pulled on me. This could be something obscene, so I'm completely protected. I've been told that this is the Chinese symbol for risk. And this is the seventh iteration of this symbol I've sent, because every time I've done this for 30 years, somebody Chinese says, no, that's not the right symbol. This is the right symbol. I think the Chinese need to get together and get their symbols nailed down. Because you got simple Chinese, you got complex. I mean, basically all these versions of Chinese and every. But let's take this as a given. Chinese. And the Chinese symbol for crisis is a combination of two symbols: danger and opportunity. Risk is danger plus opportunity. Perfect definition of risk, because it connects the two at the hip. Who amongst us doesn't want opportunity? We all want to make 70% returns, right? But then if I ask you, how much danger are you willing to face? And you say, no, I don't like danger. I'm going to say, maybe you won't make the 70% returns. You want one, you got to. Think of how many scams would be stopped if people just remember this. So when I say you can make 15% guaranteed, and I could be the greatest hedge fund manager in the world, your reaction should be, stop lying. Because if it's guaranteed, it can't be 15%. So when Bernie Madoff told people you can make 8% guaranteed, he was very clever. He didn't say 80% guaranteed. He was appealing to greed. We say, not that greedy. You're a little greedy, but that's okay. 8% guaranteed. And people put their money with them for 30 years and then discovered 8% guaranteed cannot be delivered. After the fact, do you see this happen? Anybody here from Orange County, California? Great place to live. Sun's always shining. There are no more orange groves left because real estate is worth more. Disneyland is there. But about 30 years ago, Orange County, then one of the most wealthiest counties in the United States, declared bankruptcy. You know why? Because the county took the pension fund for the county and took a third of the pension fund and bet on German interest rates going up. Interest rate derivatives. Not suppose something is. So the thing blows up. Then the guy who ran the county, the county treasurer, a guy called Robert Citron. I think everybody in Southern California invents a name. Do you really believe that the guy who runs Orange County is really a name, Robert Citron? That sounds too coincidental, right? Citrus. So maybe his name was really Robert Jones and it's Citron. So, you know, he's in the spotlight. He's on 60 Minutes. Being interviewed by Mike Wallace after the collapse. So Mike Wallace, says, Mr. Citron, why would you take pension fund money that's supposed to be invested in safe things and invested in interest rate derivatives? Okay. And he said, because Charlie Clough told me I could make 15% with no risk. You're saying, who the hell is Charlie Clough and why is he telling you these things? Charlie Clough then was the chief market strategist at Merrill Lynch. And Merrill Lynch ended up becoming a co-defendant on this lawsuit that came out of this. And let me continue the discussion. He says, and I'm not a finance person. What's your job again? County treasurer. I thought that had something to do with finance. But it was an elected position. He was really good as a politician. But do you need to be a finance person to know that if I tell you you can make 15% with no risk,
I'm lying. If you think I can make 15% no risk, you probably also think that Rolex you bought last week on Canal Street for $50 is really a Rolex. Trust me. It's not a Rolex. In fact, look at the spelling. It probably says R-O-L-E-C-K-S. Right? But there's no way Charlie Claude have told him he can make 15% no risk. You know how I know that? Because